This is Gutcast. An IBD diagnosis is life-changing at any age. However, being diagnosed as a child comes with its own distinct challenges and stresses that both child and parent face. I'm delighted to be joined by Mary Hamzawi, an IBD nurse, Rachel Kane, a mother whose child was diagnosed with Crohn's disease at 10 years old, and Brody Davies, who was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis when he was 13. Mary, thank you for coming on the podcast. I know how hard the process is to be diagnosed with IBD as an adult, but can only imagine it's even more challenging in children.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Amy. You're completely right. It's very difficult making a diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease, and it can actually be harder in children because a lot of the time you're dependent on what the parent is going to tell you the symptoms are, and it depends on the age of the child. That's also because, you know, there's an increase in incidence in very young IBD in under 10-year-olds. So it can be difficult to make the diagnosis. I mean, signs and symptoms we're all aware of, you know, abdominal pain and diarrhea and fatigue and that. And I mean, if you think of children growing up at their different ages and stages, there can be many reasons why they don't want to go to school because they have a tummy pain or, you know, and you are inclined to sort of push through. And that can be very difficult then when there is a diagnosis made after some time of inflammatory bowel disease. Parents often feel a sense of guilt because maybe they should have paid more attention back then. Sometimes it can take as long as 18 months before you get an actual diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease because the symptoms can be related to so many other things. The signs and symptoms are pretty much the same in children and adults. It's just how they express it or how they manage it, you know, because people learn to live with so much as well, which can be difficult, you know.
I think, yeah, I even can identify with that because I think in the lead up to my diagnosis, the pain was already kind of normal. And, you know, I had, when I look back, I actually had been experiencing it for years. So I could only imagine what that must be like for a child if they've had it. Can you be born with IBD, Mary, or does it's something that develops over time, or is there any research in relation to that aspect of it?
So we don't know what causes inflammatory bowel disease. We know that it's a combination of many different factors, and the latest thinking, and thanks to lots of research that's going on in Crumlin, we're very fortunate in Crumlin because it's the main centre, so children all over the country attend there, so they're in a fantastic position to be able to do research on all children in Ireland with IBD. So we are learning more as time goes on, and unfortunately the incidence is rising. So there is a genetic predisposition, we do think that, but that, and then there are other kind of environmental factors or different things as you grow older that can trigger it then. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if you have a family member with inflammatory bowel disease, you're at 20% greater chance of developing inflammatory bowel disease. You know, it depends on what you come up against and how your body reacts to different things. It's an autoimmune response. So it really depends on many contributing factors that can just trigger it. Yeah.
Yeah. Brody, I could see you nodding away there to what Mary was saying earlier. And, you know, as I had mentioned, like being diagnosed as an adult, you know, for me anyway, it was a massively life-changing experience, but I could only imagine what that was like being diagnosed as a child. Can you take us back to the time, I suppose, pre-diagnosis? You know, if you can remember that time, I know we were around 13, would I be right in thinking? Yeah. And, you know, when did you begin to see symptoms or, I suppose, start to notice things were different? And tell us about your road to your diagnosis.
There were so many things that happened like beforehand. It was more like, It probably took me about 2 years in whole to get diagnosed because like I remember like most GPs just put everything down to puberty, believe it or not. Like everything that was wrong with me was just all your body's change and all that kind of stuff. And I had to go through like strict dietary requirements for a while because they thought I was celiac, all that. Then I had to go through iron supplement, thought I was deficient in iron. Then like just one night, like everything kind of just changed because I noticed myself that like for maybe like 6 months, I was just so tired all the time. And then the one night I went to the bathroom and there was blood in like in the toilet. So then that was kind of like the, okay, like, no, there's definitely something not right here. Then I ended up telling my dad about it. So then like went back to the doctor, and then they were just like bloods upon bloods upon bloods, and then just realized that, okay, we finally have to get me down to Wexford General Hospital to see what's going on for colonoscopy and an endoscopy.
Okay, so, and was it from, as a result of the colonoscopy that it appeared, but did it show for you?
Yeah.
And what did that time feel like for you? Like as being so young and being told that you had IBD?
Just like, I don't, like, my world just kind of turned upside down. So it was just a massive shock, like, really awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rachel, I can only imagine what it was like for Brody's parents in that situation, you know, especially if they weren't aware, never heard of IBD before, and all of a sudden had this diagnosis in their family, because as we know, and I'm sure you know yourself, how it affects the entire family. Your son Tadhg was diagnosed at a very, very young age. As a parent, you had to be your son's advocate during that time in the lead up to diagnosis and thereafter, but particularly in that lead up to that diagnosis. How did you start to notice the symptoms for Tadhg?
For Tadhg, it's pretty similar to what Brody was talking about there. And, you know, he had a lot of pain, a lot of abdominal pain. And he was, you know, we thought it was certain foods were aggravating the condition, you know, what was going on with him. And this was from about 8. But, you know, when he was diagnosed and looking back, he actually had different symptoms from a lot younger. We just didn't know what they were. So from about 8, we started, you know, bringing him to the GP. He was sent to the hospital. The inflammation never showed up in his blood, so it was really tricky, you know, it never showed up. So they tested him, as Brody was saying, for celiac, you know, for all different things. And that didn't work, you know, and he was still in pain. So we brought him to a nutritionist, and that went okay for a year. He did kind of an elimination diet, and that seemed to work, and we thought, okay, you know, good, it's done, you know. But actually, it came back worse than ever. And what we know now was a flare. He had a huge flare, and his body, he was in so much pain. So we ended up in A&E more than I don't know how many times. And the consultant said to us there were actually abscess on the outside of his intestine. So they were going to call gastroenterologists up from Crumlin to do a colonoscopy. And Tadhg was diagnosed in 2011 with Crohn's disease. So that took about 2 years and all to get to that point, yeah.
And how was that for you, Rachel?
It was a very disturbing, painful journey. You know, to watch your child in pain and not actually be able to help or do anything about it. So yeah, you know, two years of kind of sleeping on the floor beside him in different hospitals. So, and when he was diagnosed, it was kind of a relief because he said, okay, we know what this is now. We can work with, you know, we can work with this. And once Tadhg went to Crumlin, everything changed for him then, you know.
Yeah, I can only imagine. It's such a relief when you get that diagnosis in adulthood. And in one sense, it's no different in childhood. You still have those years of misdiagnosis up to that point. Mary, what should parents look out for? Because children often complain of a sore tummy or being really tired.
There's been loads of interesting points raised already. Rachel's exactly right there when she mentions about, you know, asking the right questions. And it really depends when you go to your GP to give the most accurate information as you can. And because, you know, you're very anxious, it's your child and, you know, they're unwell and everybody wants to have their children healthy and well. But when things start to change, as we kind of have already said, you know, a child having a bit of tummy pain, fatigue is a big thing because children generally don't like to be tired. They like to be out there and doing stuff. So fatigue is a big thing. If they're, you know, stopping going to their sporting activities or no longer going to their drama or coming in from school and having to go to bed for a little while, like that is a big thing, I think, that you should be kind of watching. And when you do make, because we all think it is sort of, it's something in the gut, they've got pain or they've got diarrhea, and they can have episodes of diarrhea and then it goes and you think, well, that's grand, that was over, it must have been a bug or something. And you do start doing a kind of, by naturally, you sort of think, well, we'll eliminate, maybe it's dairy, maybe it's wheat, you know, and there's so much stuff out there at the moment. But when you've done those things and you know, as a mother is always right, you know, things aren't right, somebody will have to listen to you. If you go to your GP and if you feel the right questions aren't being asked or I'm not being listened to, and I don't, and I mean, GPs are extremely busy and I'm not dissing them in any way, but it is difficult to make a diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease. And if your child is waking at night, either, you know, to go to the bathroom or, you know, with pain, and when you see blood, like Brody says, because it, Brody's story is kind of nearly classical, that you're just sort of, you're going on and you're thinking, yeah, I don't have a great stomach or whatever. And then all of a sudden you see blood, and then you're kind of like, okay, now we have to act on this. And it's, you know, you get people kind of sitting up then and paying attention and doing these tests, you know. But endoscopies and colonoscopies are not easy things to do in children, so you don't want to do them unless you absolutely have to do, because you have to, you know, you have to have a general anaesthetic. So I think getting the right information to your GP, and if the GP can do the right tests, and there's a lot happening in the background within the health service to improve GPs' access to doing the right tests, like stool samples, like calprotectins, and, you know, blood tests and things like that. So there's a lot happening. Like people are becoming more aware that we need to be doing more to get this diagnosis earlier and get the treatments in and get children able to live their lives and be the best they can be.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, Mary. And Brody, to bring you in on that, as someone diagnosed so young, what was it like trying to manage IBD through your teenage years, through school and the various social engagements that start during that period?
Like, as I've always said, like, teenage years are the 1 years of your life where everyone strives to be the same and to be normal, like in air quotes, and everyone wants to, like, no one wants to stand out. So like being told you have something like a lifelong illness, and like, it's just like, okay. But yeah, like the whole teenage thing, it is tough, because like, it's just that one time of your life where like, you don't want to feel left out as such. Like, I just remember constantly just the fatigue thing for me has never really been fixed. Like, I find that I get burnt out so fast. Like, so like coming out of school and like all your mates are like, do you want to go downtown? No, like, no, I want to go home. Like, I want to go home for sleep. Like, yeah, no one really seemed to like get it as such, but like, how could they either?
Yeah, like, I suppose, like, especially with the fatigue, like, you don't want to be labeled as, usher, they're just lazy, or they're just whichever. And I can only imagine, as a teenager, you know, people think you're in the prime of your life, and you know, it's a very hard thing to communicate. Would you have had to communicate that with, say, teachers, or this was the adults around you?
My kind of way out of that was I got my mom to write me, like, even asking to go to the bathroom in secondary school is just like, I don't get it. But like, I asked my mom to like write me a note on the back of my journal, and I just waited for my principal to come out of his office, and I was just like, can you just please sign this, because I'm not having an argument with a teacher over going to the toilet. Like,
that's a huge thing, Brody. I think that's really important to highlight, because I can only imagine that, you know, you're in an urgent situation in a class full of 20, 30 other students, and you really want to be as discreet as possible, but you're in an urgent situation, and trying to tell your teacher in that moment in time must have been an added layer of...
I've walked out once or twice. Yeah. Because I was just like, no, like...
Yeah, yeah. And like, Mary, from your experience from working with patients across the board, would you have any advice from that perspective of, you know, in work situations, in, you know, even the using of disabled toilets, because a lot of people get confronted when using such, because our illness is invisible. What would you have been hearing from patients in clinics throughout the years?
No, that's a very good point, actually. And I think the ISCC no waiting cards, I think they're really good. But I just wonder, they're also not something you want to fall out of your wallet. Do you know what I mean? It's really difficult, because we don't want to be shouting from the rafters. Do you know what I mean? Look, I want preference to the toilet because I have this condition. That's probably one of the most embarrassing things about it, you know. From a childhood and from the school perspective, I think that that's something that we kind of tried to address from Crumlin for sure, in that I think it's difficult to work out with children and who they want to tell and who they want to share this with, because you don't want to be labelled, as Brody says, you just want to be part of the gang, you want to get on with your life. And that's the beauty of looking after children. They like to be well and they want to get on with their lives. But I think you need to decide between you who you're going to tell, who you're going to share it with, and at least one person in the school should know, so that there isn't an issue around toileting and going out to the bathroom or whatever. Some of the new schools can be a bit of a nightmare, because they've done this thing where they thought it was clever, where they put toilets at the back of the classroom, like, disaster. You know what I mean? Because then they don't have to leave the room, but nobody is going to go and use that toilet if they, you know, because for lots of reasons. So I think just to have somebody in the school aware, so that it's, and the child should be given permission to leave the classroom at the time. flip side of that is that other kids are going, well, how come Mary's allowed to go to the toilet or leave the class whenever she wants? So you have to be able to have an answer for that. Whatever it is you're going to decide is an acceptable story. Like, well, I have an upset tummy and sometimes I need to go out. Enough information. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think the access cards are good. I think that it is something we did years back. We did a leaflet for employers and a leaflet for students on information, actually. But again, it's a very individual thing and it's up to people how much they want to share it as well. Like, some people don't want to be, and actually that's, COVID has been very interesting about that, because people have been forced to declare themselves, as it were. We had a lot of call from young adults who were saying, look, I've been working in this company for years. Nobody has ever known that I have this condition. But now, because people with chronic disease are on medication, have to go home, I have to sort of tell them. And, you know, that's been very difficult. So
it is. Yeah, it is a tricky, tricky one. Absolutely. And Brody, just to, you know, we had mentioned with Rachel earlier that, you know, this is a family diagnosis when you're diagnosed as a child or in the early stage of your life. What did it mean for your family in particular? Did it, you know, was it affect your relationship with your parents at all? Or how was that support from them growing up?
Support was like just always there. It still is. Like, I like to credit them, to both of them. Like, I say this all the time. Like, I was going through puberty as is, so my hormones were just completely imbalanced, and then being told you have this and I'm still in a bit of pain. So I was a walking demon for about a year before everything just got sorted. So like, the patience was there, and like, I am grateful for them, like, just to be there for me. Like, my ma took it to heart. I think majority of mothers would, I know, like, because I feel as the whole thing of like actually growing the child inside you, like, it's an extent of you. Like, so my ma took it very, very to heart at that stage. My dad still thinks that one day there'll be a cure for this. And like, still like, yeah, that's his optimistic thinking.
It's great to have that positive outlook though. How did you fare when things got quite bad, like in a flare, for example? When I was quite bad, I couldn't advocate for myself because you're so fatigued, you're so exhausted, you're so unwell. I had to rely on my partner to advocate for me. I can only imagine that you had to rely on your parents to advocate for you. How was that?
I used to have friends call to the house, but like, my mom would just know that I wasn't in the humor. Like, she kind of gauged that for me from just waking up, because like, just because like, my immune system's terrible now, like, because of this. So like, every single thing I get is just like, it's the worst version. So if I get a cold, I get the flu. Like, you know, like, it always extends into something worse. So like, my mom kind of always does know. So does my dad, really. So like, when I just wake up in one morning, I'm just like, no, I'm not in the humor. Like, if they called for me or whatever, they're just like, no, he's not in or something. Like, they just make up some excuse for me. Like,
yeah. And it's important to have that, isn't it? Rachel, yeah. I can only imagine that you had to do that for Tig an awful lot. I think, like, we obviously are talking about being diagnosed as a child and a child's journey, but like, it really can't be underestimated, the role of parents and guardians in this journey and the crucial role that you play. You know, what was, as a parent, going through it yourself? Because, you know, you might not be the person living with IBD, but you've absolutely been on that journey through and through. What was the most difficult part for you?
I suppose the most difficult part, to be honest, is not be able to fix it. You know, that's really it. But, you know, you don't really do it alone. Like I said, you know, we had Mary, we had James, we had the team in Crumlin, and you have family and friends. We're like, we're very lucky to have that support system in place. Yeah. And then with the group also, the support from other parents was amazing. I couldn't have got through those last few years without being able to talk about it with somebody. Or, you know, like, we shared a lot, and what, you know, the kids had different things going on at different times, and they got to know each other. And it was, you know, that part alone, you can't do it alone. If you try and do it alone, it's so difficult, you know?
Yeah. Because you do have another child as well. So, you know, I suppose from the aspect of, you know, there being more than one child in the family, and, you know, you're trying to keep a normal life and the normal running of the household and all those kind of things that are happening, and going to school and going to the extracurricular activities and all those bits and pieces that are happening on top of, as well, with the times as Tig was quite unwell. How was that balancing act? Because I can only imagine, as a parent, never mind just trying to focus on the child who's unwell and all the stress that puts on, but trying to balance life in general, because life keeps going.
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, Andy would take, my husband, he would take say, you know, we kind of take turns. So, you know, I would do a lot of the hospital runs with Tyke, and you would be here with Shauna, or we'd change over. So we were lucky again to have two of us that we could do that. So she got to, I suppose, see from a very young age, you know, that would be normal to her, that Tyke had something going on. So really, they have a great relationship, Tyke and Shauna. But, you know, around the times that Tyke has fatigue, he'll get really grouchy. So I'd be like, Shauna, leave him now, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's hard to balance it all. But you do it because, you know, as Brody as well, I could see he doesn't let it define him. Tyke's the same, doesn't let it define him. They just get on with life. And then, yeah, okay, it's going to hit you with the fatigue and the pain and different things. But really, they're just living their lives, you know. So you can't keep them like wrapped up, you know, as much as you'd like to.
As much as you'd like to. Yeah.
I'd say no, but you know, you have to let go too. And that's it. That's yeah, important.
Absolutely. And Mary, actually, something that Rachel said there, I think, you know, one thing that's said an awful lot for the IBD community is the resilience that's in the IBD community. But like, I'd say the resilience in the IBD community in children is just second to none, because children are great for just bouncing back in one sense as well. And, you know, this is what something I have to deal with. And I suppose in later life, maybe, as Brody said, in the teenage years, you start to realize, oh, you know, this, I am like, you know, I have an illness and so on. But would that be something that you would have seen in children being diagnosed from an early age? Would it have been their parents that would have been more upset? How would the children have reacted?
So it's interesting, actually. I think, yeah, it's funny because I think there's a different reaction. At diagnosis time, in a child, it's usually a sense of relief, because it's amazing. Even like as Brody said, when you see blood, the first thing anybody thinks of, it's a worst case scenario. Do you know what I mean? You're kind of thinking, gosh, I know somebody who had this and whatever. And a child is usually a little bit relieved initially, but then realizing that, you know, they have to, that this is for life. So it takes a little bit of time to get to that sort of acceptance. And I think that with parents, there's nearly a sense of guilt and anger in the beginning, because like both Brody and Rachel have said, we were talking 2 years before diagnosis, and that's a massive amount of time in a child's life. Do you know what I mean? So from a parent's perspective, you're nearly remembering that first GP that sent you away, and should I have fought more then? And like there's only so much you can do. So it is very difficult. Children are resilient. That's what I really love, looking after children, because they have that fight through. Parents have got, understandably, you know, when you're talking about introducing medications, because the one thing about inflammatory bowel disease, it is a lifelong disease. And I think you have to get the elephant out of the room from the very beginning. There's no point in pussyfooting around that fact. It is a lifelong disease, and we have to just allow everybody to accept that. And then you can go forward from there. We have fabulous treatment options. Even since I've started, like the stuff that's available now, medications are amazing compared to, you know, when I first started working with IBD. So there is hope. I'm with Brody's dad on that one. There is hope. And, It's difficult, because everybody wants to see these people. It doesn't define people. They should still have, when you see children being diagnosed, and, you know, I would say to them, what do you want to be when you grow up? But you need to keep that aspiration. This doesn't change that, but we'll work together to find how you get there. And I think there's a fabulous team in Crumlin. I'm no longer in Crumlin now, I'm with adults. But we say the same thing to adults, you know, being diagnosed. You know, whatever career path you're on, if you know, you can still do that, you know, if you want to just start a family, all of those things. But we have to work together. And I think the thing is learning to accept your diagnosis. Rachel said, if you can't be alone, it's very difficult. But just the hospital, the people, these people are part of your team to get you well. So communication on every level, I think, is massive. You know, communication between your healthcare professionals, with your family, whoever it is you're comfortable to talk to. And if you don't want to talk to immediate family or whatever, there are people there you can talk to and reach out.
Yeah, absolutely, Mary. I think even as you were speaking there, you know, you really brought me back to the time when I was in my hospital bed and you were sitting on the edge of it and you were talking to me and you were reassuring me of my aspirations. And I said I wanted to go traveling and all those things. And I felt so put at ease and reassured. And we, like, the role an IBD nurse plays in all of our journeys is so crucial and important. We can never underestimate that. So, and you're right, we do have to think, because when we have IBD, no matter what age we're diagnosed with, we can achieve all the things we want to achieve in life, which is really important. Rachel, just to pick up on the final point that Mary made there around support, you started Gutsy Kids, which is just absolutely incredible, and a credit to you. Could you tell us a little bit more about Gutsy Kids, and I suppose how it came to be, and I suppose what do you think is the most valuable part of that group?
Well, I'd love to take credit for the whole thing, but it wasn't just me. It was myself and eight other parents at the time, all attending Crumlin. And, you know, with the support of the team there, we started the group because we had questions that couldn't really be answered during, say, you know, clinic times. And Mary and the team there, you know, at the time, they were so under pressure for so many, with so many kids and so little resources, that we, you know, came together and we had a lot of questions around things, and a lot of, you know, when you left the room, we kind of realized, who do you ask? Where do you go? You know, that type of thing. So, and also at the time, the nursing hours were very, very low in Crumlin. So there was nobody there, you know, if you had a question around medication or symptoms. So we decided to get together and start this group. And we had a couple of meetings, and just we were saying, well, what will we do first? So the first thing we did was got a message out to people, our families that were living with IBD in Ireland. And we had a national meeting in Talla in Maldon, and over 60 people came, which was amazing, that day, from all over the country. And because they didn't know there were other kids nearly in the next town or in another county that had the same thing, you know, those people come from all over at different stages of the disease, different stage in the journey. So they all came along that day. Everybody had time on the mic to, you know, tell their story, air their fears, ask questions. And from that meeting, then we built Gutsy Kids, because it was really the wants and needs of the people that were there that day, gave us what we needed. You know, it was kind of what was priority for families, and really what was priority was support. You know, communication, as Mary said, that they wanted to be able to communicate together. So that's how it came about, really. Yeah.
Having that support of a network like Gutsy Kids, knowing that you're not alone, must be invaluable to parents, Rachel.
Yeah, you know, it's such a relief to talk to people from all walks of life, from, you know, every stage of the disease, as I said, and every type of medication, that you could share your common experience and know that, hey, you know, it's going to be okay. We're going to get through this, like all of us together. So, you know, to know that somebody's at the end of it, an email, a text, the phone, you know, we had a couple of group days together, you know, so even to know that was really big help. You know?
Yeah, you're never alone. No. I think that's the best thing about Gutsy Kids as a parent, and just knowing that, you know, there is support for you there as well, because you do need support. And I suppose Tadhg has now he's an adult now.
He's an adult. I have to keep in mind myself.
But I could only imagine, you know, you've had to be an advocate throughout so much of his life for his illness, and really kind of communicate that, and you know, the struggle to find answers and all of that entails in an IBD journey. You know, how does your role change, or does it change at all, or do you still want to wrap them in, in bubble wrap?
I wouldn't be allowed. No. Yeah, it's a gradual letting go. And I think the transition is a very grey area, because, you know, he did the transition at 16, say, over to Vincent's at the time. And, you know, it was just so different, because in Crumlin, Mary will tell you, you know, that the consultants and the nurses, they almost mind the parents too. So when you go to Vincent's, it's just, no, you're just cut off. So it's almost like you don't really know what's going on with them anymore, you know, as young adults. You're in, and you feel awkward because they're that much older. You know, Ty didn't really want me in the room, which I understand. You know, and you're kind of, should I stay? Should I go? You don't know where you're really supposed to be. So it's very gradual. Nobody really gives you a rule book on it. You just have to find your way. And I think for Ty himself, it was, you know, he kind of liked the independence in one way, but got a little bit lost along the way too. So Yeah, I think it can be, you know, you're going from all of that support to, okay, you have to grow up really quick now.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Mary, as somebody who works, I suppose, who worked with children and now works with adults, would that be something that transition? Because I know you do a lot of work around the transition. It's such an important and crucial time. And how does that work?
Yeah, anybody who knows me is probably just tired of listening to this stage. So I'm 3 years in Vincent's now, and I really am only warming up. It was my first thing when I got in there. I said, we just need to be looking at the whole transition process. And that's what I've been on a mission to do, that we've now got a 16 to 24-year-old clinic so that people are focused at that clinic, that they're talking about young people. So aside from just coming to visit and going, well, how many times a day are you going to the bathroom? Do you have any issues? Your bloods look fine. That's grand. See you next time. They're kind of thinking, what are you at in your life? Are you doing your leaving cert? Remember the DARE form? Are you in college? How's it going? So we're more focused to think in those clinics. Do you know what I mean? But I think we've a long journey to go with the transition process. As Rachel says, it is a very grey area. Like, there's all this literature and everything. There should be transition clinics. There should be transition clinics. But nobody is telling us what a transition clinic should look like. Like, a lot of teenagers don't want to see me when they come to clinic. Like, here she goes again. Now she's going to be asking me if I have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, or, you know, if I'm studying, if I'm not, oh, here, come on, let me out of here. Avoiding me, ducking down the corridor. Do you know what I mean? But like, it's just about, we have a lot of work to do and there's a lot of work going on. But I think the key thing is the support. Parents, on the different kind of quizzes and questionnaires that I've done, the most important thing that's come out of it is that parents have a bigger problem with transition than the adolescents. The parents are more anxious. And I only just did a survey there a month ago, just looking at children who came over a year ago, and we're doing this control trial, as I say. And the parents, 100% of the parents were anxious about transition. And now when you ask them, well, what advice would you give people who are about to transition? They're like, you know what? Just go with it. It's actually fine. It's great. And we're very fortunate, as I say, we have a clinic, but we're trying to spread the word that if it can be done in one adult hospital, it can be done everywhere. So we're just fighting to get resources in place for a health service, for, you know, to recognize that these are 16-year-olds. Adult hospitals are looking after children. So that's the big message, to kind of make people aware. So parents should not feel that they're in the way at any point. They're welcome, and they should be made to feel welcome. They are entitled to ask the questions, and allow the child to come into it in their own time, because they're going through transition into adulthood anyway, aside from a chronic disease. So allow them to sort of be themselves. When they're ready, they will be the ones telling you. You know what I mean? But that said, you must direct your conversation to the child as a child, not as somebody with IBD or as an adolescent. And then if they want to allow the parent to answer the questions, you just kind of say, do you agree with that? Are you happy with that? And in time, they come round. But parents are not the enemy in an adult hospital. They are welcome. They should feel welcome. They shouldn't feel that they can't come in and ask the questions. People do understand the importance. They're very young. They are children going into adult hospitals, and it is different.
Absolutely. I can only imagine. And Brody, just to get your perspective, even quickly on it, you know, as a young person moving to adult care, did you notice the big change, even as Mary was saying, even right, like the smells, the building, the having to advocate, all those different things?
Yeah, definitely. It can be very daunting, like, just going up, because like my man and dad had been there like once or twice, but never like much. So then like it's the added stress of like, oh, where do we go, where do we park, like how do we ask and all, like, and then you're just kind of, you're running around and you're just like, oh my god, this, it just seems endless when you get into it as well.
Yeah, I can only imagine how that transition was for you at that time. And finally, just to kind of wrap up the episode, I've really enjoyed talking to you about this, because I think it's really important that everyone's been so honest and open about their journeys. But to go around and just ask you all if you all had one advice, because I think you all come from such different perspectives. Brody, if you had one piece of advice that you would like our listeners in this episode to know, what would that be?
For going into teenage years, I would say, like, I understand the whole thing of you want to be normal. I really, like, trust me, I do. But like, no one's normal at the end of the day. So like, just take it on your stride, take it day by day, and just don't like let anything bog you down, in a sense.
Yeah, it's a really, really important, great advice. Rachel, what would you like to get across in the final message of the episode?
As you know, kind of going back to what Mary was talking about earlier, I think communication, communicate with everybody and don't stop until, you know, you're kind of in that place where you have people to talk to all around you and you're communicating how you feel, what's going on in your life, you know, like just keep communicating and don't shut down, you know, because there's not just you, there's so many other people out there that have different things going on and they will get it, you know, if they might not have IBD, but they will understand where you're coming from. So yeah, just keep talking.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mary?
Yeah, so I think that it's really important to not beat yourself up. We don't know why you got this disease. Unfortunately, it might take time, but it is just about accepting it and working so that you can make it, you can learn to live with it. As Rachel says, as Bodhi says, reach out. Your healthcare professionals are not the enemy. You know, there's a certain amount of responsibility that you have, like when they're sort of saying, do your blood tests, you have to have your blood tests. It's not, you know what I mean? But just get as much information as you can about it. Everybody is individual as well. I need to say that because you might look at other people who've been on a journey with inflammatory bowel disease and it's been quite difficult. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that will be you. So you have to accept that this is you. It's a part of who you are and work with it and make it work for you and be your best you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Mary. And thank you to all three of you, Brody, Rachel and Mary. This has been an incredible episode and really important. And I really enjoyed talking to you.
You have been listening to Gutcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, don't forget to subscribe, rate and share. The views, information or opinions expressed during the Gutcast podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not represent those of the Irish Society for Colitis and Crohn's Disease or Janssen Sciences Ireland. The primary purpose of this podcast series is to educate and inform and is not a substitute for professional diagnosis or treatment. This podcast is supported by funding from Janssen Sciences Ireland. Participants have been reimbursed for their time.